This week on Writers, Inc.
I work in genre. I happen to believe that genre is capable of meeting the standards of what a great literary novel is. Not everyone believes that. Some people actually think the definition of genre is, well, it's not literary.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I officially finished the Ender's Game audiobook, and then last night I watched the movie.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I'm very sorry.
Well, you know, like I went into it knowing that you didn't like the movie, and like I didn't mind it. You know, like I didn't love it, I didn't hate it. I thought they could have done the big twist at the end a little bit better than the way that they did. Yeah. But you know, like they cut out a lot of stuff because they have to cut out a lot of stuff. You know, I think it was still a 2-hour movie, but it was done well.
And I give it a little bit of a hard time, but I actually did enjoy it. But it is kind of a forgettable movie. Like it's not the first thing that pops into my head when I think about Ender's Game, but
I think I watched it with my son, so I think, you know, it's kind of funny when you watch things with your kids and you're looking at it like through the lens of how they're seeing it. Like you have a completely different perspective when you watch those movies than when you then watch them like through your own adult perspective. But
yeah
I watched it, but I remember almost nothing about it, which
that's what I'm saying.
Was in it, right?
What's that?
Yeah,
Harrison Ford.
I remember the kids did a really good job. Like, I really thought that the kids did a nice job in that film.
Which would have to happen. Because, I mean, that's 99% of the story is those kids. And I think that's one of the challenges. I mean, you know, Orson Scott Card held on to the rights for that for decades. I mean, he wouldn't let just anyone do it. And when they finally did kind of convince him to do it, that was the big question mark. It was like, where are we going to find kids that can play these roles? I mean, they're basically young adults, you know, tiny adults, not young adults, but like they're strategists and geniuses, and you know, they have to have complex relationships with each other. Like, where do you find kids that could pull that off on screen? But I think they did a fair job with it.
I was thinking about that while I was watching it, because they aged them up. I think there was like 12 to 13 or so in the movie, and they starts at like 5 or 6 in the book. But there's, you know, from a business standpoint, there's a lot of rules regarding kids on film and how many hours they can work. So when you've got a cast that's primarily kids like that, it really stretches out that production and runs up your costs. So that was probably a hindrance to them too.
The effects and the way they did the battle room and all that, like that was just amazing. I felt like, you know, that they realized the sort of technical aspects of the whole thing in a way.
My son loved that. Like just, you know, even just being able to visualize like how they're like, you know, launching across the spaces and like just doing all the things that they're doing. I don't know. Yeah. He really liked it when he was younger. So I'll always have a fond place in my heart for it.
Well, I mean, the author really communicated that very well in the book. You know, like you could visualize every single one of those scenes, and like all of them were so over the top, you know, sci-fi, completely different from our own world. But he explained it in a way that made perfect sense. And I think that's partly why it translated so well to the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's extremely difficult to do, to, you know, any type of action when you've got to spell it out. And then when you take things that don't exist and have to, you know, rope those into your storyline, that just makes it exponentially harder.
Yeah. Oh, good.
All right. What is in the news?
First up, tools to identify poisonous books developed by University of St. Andrews. Arsenic was historically mixed with copper to create a vivid green for book covers. While risk of exposure among the general population of readers is low, libraries have had to separate out green books that might include the toxin, which is an irritant and can result in more serious symptoms. Thanks to the good scientists at University of St. Andrews, there's now a portable tool that can detect affected books.
So books can kill you now?
Yeah, I was reading about it. It was like the things that they mixed into books, mercury, like all kinds of stuff. But
You know that this was a thing in the
it was a
Victorian
thing.
era,
It was
because
Victorian, yeah.
women, a lot of it's you look at like the Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilmore or Gilmore Perkins, I don't know. And it's like this woman going crazy, and there was kind of like that, the hysteria and all that. But a lot of it they have found too is that, those vivid green dresses were just like loaded with arsenic. And then they also had like wallpaper. And so some of these haunted stories where it's like these people start losing their minds in their homes was because of these chemicals.
Yeah, and they have mercury in their hats and
For a very long time in Europe, once the tomato was introduced in Europe, there was the rumor that it was poisonous and that it could, kill you or at least drive you insane.
I stand
And
by
but
that.
then somebody discovered that somebody put it together that only the people from rich households are experiencing these symptoms. So what they've discovered is that rich households tended to eat on pewter plates, and the tomatoes are acidic, and so they would leach the lead from the
The lead.
pewter out into the tomato. So that's
That's
what caused that whole thing.
why we started wakes. The whole tradition of a wake is because sometimes people seem dead, but they weren't dead. So you just like put them in your living room for a couple days to see
Wake
if they
up.
woke up.
Just to
So I
be
think I'm
sure.
from some of that in my ancestral heritage, because I am from a long line of people who hate tomatoes. Like they're my mother, me, my son, and I tried really hard, like with the cherry tomatoes. I'm like, they're so good. He'd be like, they're poison. I'm like, I feel the same way, kid. I feel the same way. So
My son used to eat tomatoes like an
evolution.
apple. He still will just bite into it and eat the whole thing.
Yeah, I like tomatoes. I can eat tomatoes like that.
Yeah.
All
But
right.
anyways, I looked this up. So this is only like mid to late 1800s. So unless you have,
That makes sense.
Victorian green books, you're probably okay.
I have a whole lot of green books from the 1800s, so now I need to get this
This
kit.
explains a lot.
I'm reading Count of Monte Cristo right now, and one of the characters in there doses himself with silver, thinking that it's going to fight off disease and sickness, and like that was the general thinking back then.
People still
Not
do
that we've
that.
really, they still do. And like all that's really changed is the medications and the manufacturers, but in a way we're still kind of doing that same thing.
It's kind of interesting to know that that's where some of like even the mythology around like vampires and silver and just all these different things that go into it and how it, what they thought was happening versus like now we know, but still those little things, their fingerprints just still stay stuck. Quite fascinating.
It's cool.
All right, well, next up, speaking of vampires, Stephen Colbert launches the Late Show Book Club. As the announcement points out, Colbert isn't the first late night host to hit the book club. Jimmy Fallon's book club has highlighted and promoted big hits, and Colbert is launching his own book club with Orbital, Samantha Harvey's Booker Prize-winning sci-fi novel. It remains to be seen if Colbert's book club will have a presence on The Late Show itself, but the host says future updates can be found on The Late Show's Instagram page.
All the celebrities get in their own book clubs.
I'll
I
start
like
my own
it.
book club.
I'm glad. I think the more books that we can promote and talk about, the better for everything.
Do you think this is like indicative of a trend like back toward reading as a preferred,
I want to believe that it is, but at the same time, I'm looking at it thinking that this might mean that the trend has jumped the shark. Like if literally everybody's got a book club at this point, like, I don't know.
I think that, but then I also think, I don't know. I know that like millennials and then even Gen Z, especially with Bookstagram, actually started like trending towards millennials with Bookstagram was buying the book. But I do think that there's been some trends with Gen Z that they read more now than other generations. So I don't know. I mean, I think as things get more like technological, there is always like an urge to swing the other direction. And I think reading, we're just starting to see, I hope we're just starting to see the beginning of that. I don't know. I would like to think so. I'm holding on to that, JD. I don't care.
No, I mean, I'm there. Like, I would love to see more people reading and more people picking up books. But, Stephen Colbert and books, like those two things to me don't necessarily go together. And I've got a feeling he's going to have a hard time landing on the titles that are can actually resonate with his particular audience, which is another whole tricky thing because the people that, tend to read books, I don't know that they're the same people that are watching Steve Colbert at night. You know what I mean? Like, it seems to me like it's a slightly different audience.
I think it'll end up skewing political, which is going to just,
That's what I was trying to say without actually saying it. So yeah, you're right.
Well, count
Jimmy
on me.
Fallon's book club has done really well. I mean, I was actually, I didn't know how that would go because kind of the same thing, like just a comedian and late night. But I think he only does it every summer, though, if I remember right. But they have like a voting thing, and it gets, if you land on that list, like it gets you a lot of publicity.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not going to turn down landing on any of these lists, by the way,
In
if
case
they
there's any
happen.
producers listening.
That's right. Well, speaking of book clubs, Oprah shamed him. He's back anyway. James Frey was, for a time, one of the most infamous nonfiction writers in America. And then someone checked the facts. In 2005, Oprah Winfrey selected his memoir, A Million Little Pieces, for her book club, only to learn that he had fabricated parts of his story about drug addiction and his time in rehab. She shamed Frey on national TV for betraying the American public, and his publisher offered refunds. He was branded a villain, a fraud, and became perhaps the first canceled man this century. Now it's 20 years later, and James Frey is back with a new adult novel, Next to Heaven. He argues that in post-truth media climate, his past fabrications look quaint while his writing still, quote, tears people to shreds. He's positioning himself as an uncancelable literary outlaw. Frey says most memoirs blur fact and fiction, claims he was doing autofiction before the word existed, and insists today's writers play it safe for fear of being canceled. The Smoking Gun editor who originally exposed Frey doubts the story would cause much outrage now. Even Oprah Winfrey publicly apologized to him in 2011. Now Frey counsels other publicly shamed figures. He says that scandal hasn't stopped him from selling books or chasing big deals.
I just found this so fascinating. Like, this was a outrage over him blend like doing some creative nonfiction, and he was a drug addict. It was his experience. And I'm like, this poor guy had his life canceled for like 20 years.
I mean, I remember when it happened. James Frey is an interesting guy because it wasn't just that he sort of blended, but he went on, the whole like circuit and basically said that everything in there was 100% factual and true. So he sort of doubled down. He didn't really admit to it until he was called out. But I also saw this other thing, and I don't know if it's true or not. But about this book is that at some point, maybe in a newsletter or somewhere, he said that he relied on AI to help him write it.
On the current book?
I thought
That he
that
was
wasn't
very,
true, but maybe
I
it
don't
is.
know. I don't know, but
I thought there were accusations, and he doubled down saying that he absolutely did not. I don't know.
I don't know. Someone had, and again, it was like a screenshot of something. So God knows, maybe it was edited, maybe it was whatever, but it was basically him saying that, yeah, he did.
But okay, but let's be clear about terms then, though. Like, what does that mean that he had AI, quote, help him write it? Did he have it write for him, or did he just leverage it for something?
It was worded in a weird way. It was something like, God, I knew I should have sent it to Christine when I saw it. I know it was something like that he used, I think it said Gen AI to draft significant portions of the book. Did it end up staying? I don't
That's
know.
still kind of vague. I mean, draft, if did he drop them in whole cloth or did he rewrite them? I don't know, man.
I
I don't
don't
even
know.
care. James
I
Frey.
just thought this thing was so fascinating because he was like, I put some stuff in my memoir that about me being a drug addict and that I was. It wasn't true. And I was like, who cares? I don't know. I just like, who cares?
Were we expecting like full 100% credibility from the drug addict? Is
I
that what
don't
we were
know. Like,
asking
I'm like,
for?
do you really think
Well,
every memoir that you read is like 100% true?
I've
don't
never
know.
once thought that, and I love reading memoirs, and I think fully 80% of every memoir is complete BS anyway. I mean,
Yeah, it's fun. It's entertainment. I
that's
mean,
the whole
there's
point.
truth in it, but it may not be factual truth, you know?
I
Oh,
have
wow.
written so many memoirs for famous people, and I can tell you every single one of them embellishes
Yes.
everything that
Yeah.
goes into that book. And it's no different than somebody at a coffee shop telling you a story about something that happened to them the day before. They embellish on it. They take the tale. It gets a little wilder, a little crazier, you know, every time they tell it. And then they tell that story 2 years down the road, it's going to be even crazier than the first time. You know,
Yeah.
memoirs are no different. I don't know how far this guy pushed it. I didn't read this book.
If I remember right, it wasn't just like slight embellishments of the truth to make himself look better. I think that he, I th it, when I remember thinking like, wow, that was brazen, what he did. So, and I
Yeah,
don't,
and
that was a long time ago, but anyway.
there's a line there. I think everybody does it to some extent, but if you're going to double down on the lies, I think that's a problem. I think you gotta own the fact that you know made something a little more colorful than it probably was, and just leave it at that.
Yeah, I think he went really far in the memoir and then, like, essentially made it seem like that was all 100% factual when he went on his PR blitz. And so it was a
That's an
little.
issue. Yeah, just tell the truth. We don't care. We just want to be entertained. Just tell us the truth about what you did.
So anyway, that's what I
Anyway, it is a very lengthy article. You can read it and make up your own mind.
Hey, this is Kevin Tomlinson. It seems to me like you might need a little help. Maybe hand off all that stuff that's keeping you from writing. At Author Anchor, we connect authors with skilled, affordable virtual assistants trained specifically for the publishing world. Your personal VA handles everything from book production to marketing and social media, freeing you up to focus on what matters most, your writing. Book a discovery call today and we'll find that perfect VA for you. Plus, mention the Writers Inc. podcast and you'll get $50 off your first month. Visit authoranchor.com and get matched with your personal VA so you can just write.
JD, with that, who is up this week?
This week we've got New York Times bestseller Laura Lippman on. Since her debut in 1997, Laura's been recognized as one of the most gifted and versatile crime novelists working today. Her series novels, standalones, and short stories, they've all won major awards, including the Edgar and Anthony. She's here to talk craft and tell us all about her book, Murder Takes a Vacation, which releases June 17th. Here she is, Laura Lippman.
Okay, Laura Lippman, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. You have a new book out, Murder Takes a Vacation, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. But before we get to that, we have a lot of writers in our audience, and they like to know how writers got their start. So I would love to hear how you got your start.
I mean, that's a story that has multiple entry points, but I'll start with the fact that, see if I can get this right. In 1991, I had an old friend who I knew from summer camp, Jacob Weisberg, and he had ended up working at the New Republic in Washington around the same time I had ended up at the Baltimore Sun, the Evening Sun in Baltimore, and he had a party. It was a 70s party, which Jacob was younger than I was, so for him, the party was a lot more ironic. And just one little snippet from the party is Malcolm Gladwell was there with a full fro wearing a disco jumpsuit, dancing to Kung Fu Fighting.
That's
Because
fabulous.
he wasn't Malcolm Gladwell yet. None of us were any of us yet. And I went to this party. Jacob's someone I really love and is a good friend. But I was older. I was on the older side. There's a 6 year age difference, which can seem huge when you're 32 and everybody else is 26. And so I started talking to a woman who was a little bit older than I was. And it was just sort of that like party back and forth, like, hi, I'm Laura. I'm a reporter at the Evening Sun. Hi, I'm Michelle. Ba 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 ba. How do you know Jacob? Ba 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 ba. Oh, and then she says to me, hey, look. I have this contract to do a book of erotica, very high end, I need submissions. I am, you can use a pseudonym. It pays $1,500 and I need the stories by July 1st. I still don't get $1,500 for a short story. And it was just sort of like, it was the person I was talking to was Michelle Slung. She was the former editor of Washington Post Book World. She had worked at Mysterious Press. She had worked at other publishing companies where she had literally discovered Marcia Muller, one of the early female PI writers, in the slush pile. And it just happened to be the lady I talked to at a party.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a story for her. There was a sequel. I wrote another story for her. And at some point she said to me, I think you have a novel in you. Do you want to write a novel? I was like, absolutely. And she told me two things. First of all, she's like, if you write it, show it to me. I will be brutally honest. I will be brutally honest about whether it's publishable. If it is publishable, I'll help you find an agent. And she said, I also want you to think about the fact that a lot of women need the mask of a genre to write.
Mm.
She said, I meet lots of men who have no problem saying I'm going to write the great American novel.
Yeah.
But women are socialized to be self-deprecating, to be modest, and that it helps a little to, again, it was her phrase, the mask of genre. I love crime fiction. By that point, I had read Sue Grafton, Sarah Paretsky, Marcia Muller, Linda Barnes, Carl Hyas, and Walter Mosley. And it just made perfect sense for me to try to write a PI novel set in my hometown of Baltimore. And I made a deal with my then husband, first husband, that if we use the money I got for writing those short stories to buy a computer, because a Mac Classic 2 in 1991 cost more than like a top line MacBook Air would cost
now.
Yeah,
they're expensive.
And he said, okay, we'll spend the money on that, but you have to write the book in a year. And I had a full-time job and I got up every morning and I worked on my first novel. And by the fall of 1994, I had a novel that I showed to Michelle and she said, lose the prologue and I can help you sell this. And it took a little while for her to do matchmaking, but she got me to the woman who is still my agent. And that's how I broke into the business.
Wow. Right party at the right time. And I just, you know, thinking about that now, if we did a 70s parties now.
Oh, God.
It would be the year, if we did it 20 years before, it would be a early 2000s party. So we
did you know, it's so funny because, like, I know what the 70s were. I know what the 80s were.
Yeah.
I don't even, like, if you told me I was going to a 90s party, I'd be like, huh?
I guess you have to wear like buffalo plaid and Nirvana shirts. I don't know. That would be there. That would be our 90s party.
Like there would be this. Oh man.
I can't even imagine throwing a 2000s party. I have no idea what that would be. Hoodies with blazers over them, I guess. Wasn't that an early 2000s thing?
See, this is just at a certain point you get my daughter, who's only 15, knows all of this stuff. All I know is that I do a Peloton workout twice a week and it's just 80s, 80s, 80s. Because those are like the songs I know and they're fast and they're peppy. And it's like, I know the music from the 90s. I probably know some of the other music, but I'm always like, yeah, I don't know it that well. I want to write to the stuff that I can sing along with.
There you go. So I want to just get back to a couple of things that you said. First of all, I love that you got your start in erotica. It just amazes me how many authors I talk to that got their start writing erotica because it made money to fund other things that they wanted to write. And I think that is fantastic. But when you said the mask of genre, I'm thinking like that is sticking with me because a lot of women will write romance and things like that. Was it harder for you to write a PI novel? Was that still a mask of genre or...
That was definitely the mask of genre because as long as I wasn't, you know, I could have, and there would have been nothing wrong with me saying, No, I have confidence that I'm a great literary talent and I'm going to try to write a great literary novel. And lots of women have done that, and my hat is off to them. I wasn't bold enough. I wasn't brave enough. I needed this sense of, don't want to call it gimmick, but I just wasn't someone who believed that I had the right to announce myself as a literary writer. I work in genre. I happen to believe that genre is capable of meeting the standards of what a great literary novel is. Not everyone believes that. Some people actually think the definition of genre is, well, it's not literary. There's a review by Nick Hornby. He used to write for McSweeney's. It was like Things I Bought, Things I Read. And he was reviewing Mystic River by Dennis Lehane. And he said, well, gosh, it seems to me that a genre novel that does everything a literary novel would do, but also does all the things that a genre novel would do, he said that might even be superior. He said that he felt that genre novelists got, they lost points for not showing their work. Like the old-fashioned idea of when you work a math problem, you had to show what you were doing. And according to Hornby, this is not, these are not my words, Hornby was like, literary novelists get credit for showing their work, but it seems to me that if you achieve these effects without showing your work, it's like angels dancing on the head of a pin. And again, he was not talking about my work. Nick would go on to review my work. I think he had read somewhere that some people thought I was like the American Highsmith, which is weird because Highsmith is the American Highsmith. People forget she's from Fort Worth. And he's like, Highsmith is like a steak, and Lippman is like a big American cheeseburger. And I think that's good. I think I'm happy to be a big American cheeseburger. And I think that's actually pretty accurate. I think that my favorite writers are using genre almost subversively. And they're ticking the genre boxes. They're satisfying the genre readers, but they could satisfy the literary readers if the literary readers would show up. James Cain, who's one of my idols, I think does that time and time again.
And I've always found this argument fascinating because I don't even know sometimes where the literary genre line gets drawn.
I'm so glad you talked about it that way because there's this horrible phrase, we all know it, which is about transcending the genre, which suggests that genre lies in a plane and literary fiction is above it. But I think if we think of literature as a map of really ill-defined territories, and there's this overlap all around. You think about a writer like Daniel Wiedrell. He's literary and he's crime. Richard Price. Say Tana French. Like, I mean, where are you gonna, they don't really slot anywhere. James Crumley, like they're also Mosley. Like the most interesting stuff is happening at the borderlands where no one's really sure who's in control.
I sometimes think the genre and literary labels are fiction. I went into the same bookstore. I used to love, or I still love, Kelly Link, who writes short stories, and she was in fantasy. And then after she won an award, I was looking for her in fantasy, and she wasn't there. She was in literary. I'm like, wait. And so they'd moved them all, and I'm like, that's just the silliest marketing.
Yeah, I mean, they are, it is marketing. I mean, and bookstores are just trying to organize their books so that their customers have an optimal experience. So the customer who walks in and says, "This is what I like," they have the best chance of finding it if the bookstore uses pretty traditional subject categories. I don't think the bookstores care. No, it's a marketing decision, which is fine because everyone wants their work to be found. It's not a decree delivered from on high there's like not a board that convenes every year and is like literary, 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 romance, literary, historical. And then, you know, the worst category of all, in that it's just a total, can I curse on here? Am I allowed
to? Oh, go ahead. Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So it's like a total bullshit category. It's the woman's novel.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Every
what does
novel
that mean?
Is the woman's novel. Ian McEwan has been quoted as saying, when women cease to read the novel will be dead.
Yes.
The novel belongs primarily to women as consumers. Obviously, there are men who read it. There are men who write them. But women drive fiction. So what is the woman's novel other than a novel that you've decided has to somehow be set apart? I don't know.
Exactly. We've gotten way into the weeds with this, but I love
this
discussion because I'm just like, I would argue some of the best novels I've read are labeled genre. So I will leave it there.
I got no fight with you for sure.
There you go. So you have this wonderful story. You have the same agent. You've had a long career. And now we have your new book out. So let's talk about that. Murder Takes a Vacation. Do you even know what book number that is?
I'm very confused about it. It gets, I believe it's book number 29, unless you include the children's book, and then it's technically 30.
Okay.
I think. But so I like right 30. About there. Right about there. Yeah.
30. So landmark novel number 30. We're going to go with that. It's about a former private investigator who is a middle-aged widow. And she takes...
Oh, she's old. Let's be clear. She's 68.
She's old. 68.
She's old. That's, I mean, I'm 66.
Yeah, okay,
who,
fair
are we,
enough.
What are we, who are we? Yeah, we're old. We're old.
And she takes a vacation and it doesn't go so well. Let's talk about her because she is old. She is widowed. She is, not slight in stature.
She's fat.
Yeah,
that's a
she's,
word.
She's a big woman. What inspired you to write this?
A lot of things. Mrs. Blossom was a character that's existed in the Tess Monahan series since 2008.
Okay.
But when I first started writing her, I was significantly younger than she was. And then you have that weird thing that we age so much faster than our characters. I have been radicalized by the work of several women who have done a lot of writing on the idea of, the best term is anti-fatness, that is recognizing that anti-fatness is a particular bias and bigotry in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Some people call it fat phobic, but some people are like, no, you're not allowed to be scared of something that's just part of life.
Yeah.
That would be like being, oh, I'm table phobic. Oh my God, there's a table. And these people include Aubrey Gordon, who wrote Your Fat Friend and is on the podcast Maintenance Phase. Virginia Soul Smith, who runs a newsletter and podcast called Burnt Toast. Kate Mann, who was nominated for a National Book Award for her book Shrinking. And these are people who are all begging us to rethink our cultural attitudes toward fat people.
Yeah.
Toward fatness. And most of them reject the term obesity, which is medically vague. And when you dive into it, is actually kind of meaningless. And the really interesting thing is the science is catching up with them. They've been trying to tell people for quite some time that there are a lot of people on this planet who try very hard to follow the old calories in, calories out rule, and they don't lose weight. And no one believes them.
Yeah.
And the semi-glutides are like a whole other topic I won't even get into, although the semi-glutides are actually kind of proving their point, because it's early yet, and a lot of people are like, oh, well, the semi-glutides help people eat less, so it's calories in, calories out. There are other scientists and doctors who are like, no, the semi-glutides reorganize the way the body uses its own fat stores.
Mm.
It's changing your chemistry. I read this one guy who said, if I'm right about what I think is happening, the last 80 years of research into fatness and obesity have all been so wrongheaded. It's amazing. So this was all very interesting to me. I was someone who happened on my own to give up dieting in 2018, but that doesn't mean I was instantly free of our culture's anti-fat biases.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I have this fat character. I don't think I did right by her. I feel like she's an opportunity to write about a lot of isms, about anti-fatism, about ageism, about the way we stigmatize people who don't have a partner. Yeah. I was like, here's Mrs. Blossom, and she's, I don't like calling her a vehicle. I feel very precious about her. But she was an opportunity to write about so many things in the culture while at the same time just doing a super fun send up of kind of like, there's charade, there's the Maltese Falcon,
yeah,
there's murder on the Nile. It was like, how many elements of classic golden age mysteries can I work into this? And it gave me, we talked about genre, right?
Yeah.
I'd never written in the so-called subgenre, the subgenre of the so-called cozy.
Yeah.
It's There's very a traditional cozy. Mystery.
Yeah.
Hardest book I've ever written in my life. The hardest. Like, it just, and there's more bigotry even within genre. There are people who are like, oh, who cares about the cozy? It's just women shopping and talking to their friends. Cozies are great.
They are.
And as someone who's written some pretty dark, intense stuff, this is the hardest book I've ever written in my life to date.
Yeah.
There's almost a formal, elegant structure to it. The cozy is, I love poetry. I can't write it. I love it too much to try to write it. The cozy is like a sestina or an absidarian, a poem that has to have 26 lines and go A to Z. It has a somewhat, I don't want to call it rigid because that sounds wrong, but it has a formal structure that is so much harder than writing a hard-boiled book. And I also felt that it had this opportunity to be really socially relevant.
Yeah.
Like, how do you write about 68-year-old women?
Yeah.
And their hopes, their dreams, their fears. And it's like, well, you can kind of do that if they're running around looking for a statue.
I love that. There's so much that you just said there. So I noticed too, when the book starts, she has the cultural biases about herself. She doesn't want people looking at her.
She likes herself. She
likes herself.
Actually comfortable with herself, but she's aware that most people she meets are not comfortable with her.
Yeah.
You
she's
know,
used
that,
to not being looked at. And then when she's taken and put in these beautiful fashions, it's a very different experience for her to be looked at.
Yes.
Yeah.
or to even consider the idea that one doesn't age out of wanting to love how you look.
Yeah.
That you don't, you know, there's a moment in the book where someone says, she's like, you're wearing your hair. It's a non-fashion. It's like, wear it short, wear it long, wear it up. But like, you can't just wear this sad little bob anymore. You know, pick a lane. And she's like, I would, you know. And I do think that women, as they age, it's not even original. It's now just part of cultural canon. Oh, you're going to become invisible. Mm-hmm. People aren't going to see you. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And this is kind of correlates with something that happened to me during the pandemic, where I was like, well, I'm stuck at home most of the time. I can go out for walks.
Yeah.
I'm a single, right? I get to go to the grocery store once a week. But I'm now 66. So when the pandemic started, I was 61. And I had this very, you know, not huge, not fancy, but I've been more or less the same size for 30 years. And I had most of my clothes. I had a lot of clothes. And it was like, well, what if I just put on a different outfit every day? And I took selfies and I put them up on Twitter. And I walked around my neighborhood in, you know, South Baltimore. You know, it's kind of sort of gentrified, kind of, you know, gentrified and hard-boiled at the same time. It's an interesting combination. And I just was like, I'm going to put on nice clothes and I'm going to walk around. And people noticed.
Huh.
I wasn't invisible.
Yeah.
Like, because I didn't want to be invisible. I wasn't accepting. I mean, sure, by the way, you know, 25-year-old men don't see me. But a lot of people began to see me again because I began dressing in a way that seemed to indicate that I wanted to be seen. Bright colors, dresses, big earrings, you know, cool shoes. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. I mean, I think that there are lots of ways in which older women, older people become invisible.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you can kind of push back against that. And you know, I just, Mrs. Blossom is basically, in some ways, we're not that much alike because she's shy and modest and, you know, just very closed in, and I'm extroverted and immodest and a little bit flamboyant. But we're sort of following that same trajectory, which is, what if you bought some gorgeous clothes? What if you decided to buy French boots? What if you got big bangles? What if you bought like a crazy gorgeous caftan? What if you learned to put your hair up? And those things all sound so trivial, but when you're in a culture that would be so happy to erase you and not see you, it actually feels like, oh, I don't want to overstate it, but there's something to be said for insisting on being seen.
Yes.
Despite your age, despite your gender. Like I get it. I get it that I'm moving through a world that, like, yeah, nobody's like looking at me as like, oh, I wish you were my girlfriend, except maybe a man outside of 7-Eleven earlier. I got catcalled outside of 7-Eleven at like 7:30 in the morning. I was like, okay, that's just a little bit weird.
That's fun though.
But it feels, if not subversive, at least bold.
Yeah.
To sort of say, hey, and like one of my favorite Stephen Sondheim songs is, I'm still here. I got through all of last year and I'm here.
Exactly.
And you know, my own mom just died last year. She died at the age of 93. And she was someone, she was modest. She was sweet. She was not the least bit showy. But man, she cared about her clothes. And she cared about, you know, make sure your brows are tinted. And,
yeah.
My sister is only 3 years older than I am. And she's in memory care for Parkinson's. And when my mom was alive and we would go visit her, my mother, I'd drive her home and she'd be like, okay, we need to get your sister to the beauty salon. She needs her roots done.
Yes. I love it.
And she's like, and I was like, mom, I was like, there's a lot going on there. And she's like, she should look good.
Yeah.
She should look good. My mom thought that it was important that she should be dressed nicely in good clothes and clean clothes. And it was something, I mean, I now kind of, I'm trying to carry that torch for the two of us now that my mom's gone.
Yeah. I love that so much. I'm going to go into my coffin with a bottle of dye in my hair. So,
yeah,
yes,
for sure. Yeah. I always tell people that, like, when the zombie apocalypse comes, I'm going to go grab the woman who tints my eyebrows, whom I like very much. And she's got a husband and a son. So we'll get them too. And then we're going to go around the beltway and we're going to go to my trainer's house because he can hunt with a bow and arrow and he has a generator.
So perfect.
I had like a zombie apocalypse pod all planned out. It's like these three households, my eyebrow tinter and my trainer who can hunt with a bow and arrow, will be fine.
Oh, I love that so much. I have so many more questions I want to ask, but the time has just flown away from us. No, it's wonderful. It was a wonderful discussion. So I guess I'll just close with one question that we like to ask everyone. If you could offer some advice to newer aspiring writers, what would you tell them?
So this is going to be kind of more specific to the time we're living in.
Yeah.
In which there's all this discussion about AI. And
there is.
Full transparency, I'm a plaintiff in one of the AI lawsuits because my work was scraped to train LLMs. And I don't think that should be done. I wasn't asked. I didn't give my permission. I wasn't given compensation. But this sounds so obvious to writers, but apparently there's some would-be writers who need to hear this. If you want to write, you don't get to use AI. AI is the antithesis of creating your own worlds, creating your own words. I mean, sure, do I sometimes sit down at my desk and then I'm like, oh, Google, what is, you know, the most popular car sold in America right now? I might look for a fact, I might look for a detail. But the whole point of being a writer, especially if you're writing fiction, is it comes from here, it comes from inside your head. You're given this chance to create your own worlds, and you can't delegate that. You can't contract it out. I mean, if you think about AI, let's call AI a person. It's named Alfred Isaac. And like the minute you say, hey, Alfred Isaac, come in here and do this for me. Well, then you're basically one of these established fiction writers who use their name to give other people an opportunity to write their book. But in which case, like people like James Patterson, they give full credit and they pay the people who write these books very, very well.
Yes.
The idea that you're talking to this super imperfect computer program, I don't know what you call AI, but if you want to write, write. I do not subscribe to this idea that no one loves to write, everyone loves having written. I get the sentiment, the original sentiment was from a famous sports writer whose name I'm not going to be able to pluck out of my head right now. I get that what he's really saying is that writing is hard and most people are happiest when it's done.
Yeah.
Although I don't even agree with that.
No, I think you have to love the process, or writing is maybe not for you.
I love writing.
Yeah.
I love writing. I even love the not writing. I love the hard days. I love the days where it's like, this isn't going to work. I have been really in a tough battle with the work in progress. Yeah. And it wasn't going well. And it wasn't going well. And I felt like I was fighting it. And like, just like, you know. And this week I sat down and said, okay, you teach writing, be your own teacher. What's wrong here? And it's like, oh, stakes. I don't have stakes. Doesn't make sense. And I sort of rethought the main character and who they were and what their stakes were. And I'm going to say what I literally told my crime writer friends in the group chat. I said, it was like unclogging a toilet, but in a good way. Yeah. So, I mean, really, The only way to learn how to write is to write and to read, yeah. and to read and to write. And there is no computer program that can do this for you. And to even try to use one is to sort of reveal that you don't actually want to write. You just want to be what you think a writer is in your head. But the thing is, writers write.
So I thought it was really interesting when Laura said that sometimes writers feel more comfortable hiding behind the mask of genre rather yeah. than writing the great American novel. Like, that really stuck with me. So, like, I didn't feel bold enough or brave enough. I want to hear your thoughts about that. It's such a bee in my bonnet. I have so many thoughts, but I want to hear your thoughts.
This is a thought-provoking interview.
We need to figure out what year was this, because this was a while ago, right?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, she's been writing for a while, right?
So. Well, she said that party she went to was in the 90s, like 1991. Right. And so, yeah.
Yeah, so like this has changed tremendously over the years. So I think back in the day, that might have been very true. I mean, it's one of the reasons why a lot of people use pen names, you know, all that stuff, you know, evolved from then. I think in today's world, there's so much transparency with social media and everything online. You know, like you can't even do it anymore. If she wanted to write, you know, something that was completely out of genre, you know, like people out themselves right away, you know, like Nora Roberts and J.D. Robb, you know, like you go to her webpage and like that's on there. You know, like they don't even try to hide it anymore. Yeah. But back then you could, and, you know, hiding behind a pseudonym or genre, all those things, you know, the publishers kind of forced your hand. They made you do it.
Yeah. I think there is something to, there's still a sort of bias against genre fiction in certain circles for sure. I mean, my most recent experience was I had submitted my latest Dan Kotler book to a few different contests, competitions. And one of them, I got a kind of like an honorable mention kind of thing. And what it did was include feedback from a professional editor, and they, you know, a whole critique of the book and everything. And she, when she wrote to me to tell me her thoughts on the book, she opened with, you know, genre fiction just stands no chance of winning things like this because, you know, it's just, I don't know. She just kind of went off on the whole fact that it was a genre novel. If it had been a literary novel, she might have given it more credence, was the implication. So, still happens.
Yeah, I do think that, yeah, people... genre fiction is interesting because, I mean, you know, so much of fiction was genre fiction. Like, that's where it came from, like, historically. You know, I mean, there was, like, novels, but, like, a lot of it was very genre, a lot of the classics and, like, the, you know, the Greeks, if you want to go all the way back in time there, right? You've got your tragedies and your comedies, which is genre fiction. Like, it's kind of a weird thing where we came across, like, this great American novel and then stuck with it for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think... I don't know why people get so fussy about it, to be honest.
If you were to take the balance sheet of one of the big publishers, genre fiction is paying the bills.
Right. Yeah.
Like, genre fiction is the reason that they're able to publish literary fiction. But, you know, that being said, anybody writing or reading literary fiction has always kind of thumbed their nose at genre fiction. It's just, it's always been there. If you can find that magic mix of both, though, you know, like she had brought up Dennis Lehane, you know, like that is the perfect mix. You know, mix of both worlds. You know, he combines, you know, thrillers with literary, and, you know, he grabs people from both sides.
Yeah. I think to kind of a lesser extent, but still feels like it's in the same vein to me. Like, I love a lot of what John Grisham writes, especially lately, like his whole Camino Island series that he started. You know, there are some elements of that feel very literary. And it's kind of buried in the, I mean, it's not buried. I mean, it's right there out front. It's the whole book. And then he kind of inserts the thriller elements into it. You know, they don't end up being the primary story, but I don't think anybody would read him and say, oh, he's a literary, you know, he's a literary novelist. I think people are too accustomed to thinking of him as a genre writer, a thriller writer.
I just
One of the examples I used to throw out there with mentoring students and when I taught classes is Lisi's Story by Stephen King. Yeah, I'm a huge Stephen King fan. That's no surprise. But like, he purposely went out and decided to write a literary novel. That skewed just slightly horror thriller. So if you're familiar with Stephen King's writing and then you pick that up, like you can hear his voice, but you can see the differences. So if you really want to understand what a literary novel looks like versus genre, like that's a good starting point.
I do think that it kind of comes down a little bit to like elitism, because genre fiction I think tends to be more accessible, and I think like literary fiction almost tries not to be accessible, like those are, and there's like a snootiness to it too, even, right? Like, oh, I read literary fiction, even if they don't call it that, but it's, they're not, they value the inaccessibility of it, I suppose, like the intellectualism of literary fiction, which I think is why they do like novels without punctuation or like whatever weird thing that they're doing, right? Like,
You know, it would be super fun. It would be to take like a solidly genre book, that's at a lower reading level and just like up the Fleischman level to
oh,
like college
that'd be
level and
fun.
like re-put
Oh, that'd be fun. I would do
it
that. Yeah, I was gonna say I actually think that in certain respects for the writer, writing literary fiction would actually be much easier than writing genre fiction.
in
Almost
some ways, yeah.
lazy, because all you gotta do is you gotta up the language, right? You gotta up the reading scale. Where is it gonna fall on Fleischmann's? And it doesn't actually have to have it, there, you don't have to worry about describing action. You could zero in on one tiny little like worthless fact about this character, and that becomes some sort of metaphor, and you don't even have to define it. You just have to describe it in great detail for three chapters.
I enjoy reading literary fiction too. So I don't want to crap on literary fiction,
I've
but
read
I do
some
feel like there
good
is some.
stuff. I'm
But
just saying,
I have
I
never
think it's
felt
lazy.
compelled ever. I've never been like, I want to write a literary novel. That has never been a thing
No.
I want to do.
I have. I've wanted to.
The only literary novels that I enjoy, and I'm fine saying this, I mean, maybe there's an outlier here or there, but they are the ones that have genre woven into them. So they still follow the beats and some sort of structure. I've read most of the literary novels I've read that don't have that. I give up because I'm like, I don't even know what is happening in this novel. Like, I don't know who we're talking about. I don't know what's going on. I like it just, it's not,
Know. Sometimes I get swept. I remember I read this one. It was called The Year of the Death of Ricardo Reis, and like literally nothing happens in it. He
Oh,
just
that's
walks
the other
around
secret.
town, and the book was so good. Like, I enjoyed it. I couldn't tell you why.
The other secret is the title has to be lengthy and non sequitur.
There you go.
Long live genre fiction.
Long live genre fiction. So Laura kind of wanted to push some cultural perceptions with the book that she just did. And I'm just curious if you ever think about that, about writing something you believe culture has wrong from a different perspective.
I do enough of that on social media.
Oh, Kevin.
I wouldn't be opposed to doing it. I'm trying to think if I've ever done it. I don't know that I have, but it's not because I don't want to. I just haven't really run into a scenario where it makes sense for the story.
Like to have like a message in the
Yeah, because
that.
she was, I guess, challenging society's perception of fat women, right? So that was kind of
I mean, I'd argue that most fiction does that in very subtle ways. I mean, like, you pick up most fantasy, right? Most fantasy novels are sort of a discussion against fascism in some shade, right? Against it's a discussion of power, class. Like, I think that those go into a lot of books. I don't know if I would ever start from that place, because I do think sometimes when you start from those places, it can be a little on the nose, maybe, or like kind of feel like, you're talking at the reader instead of like drawing them into the world and allowing them to draw their own conclusions based on the story that you've written. So I think that there can be a danger if you like really want to write a message book in that.
Yeah, and allegory tends to give a book a shelf life. a limited shelf life. And so if your goal is, I'm writing this book to call out the injustice of thing X, in a few years when thing X isn't really anything anybody's thinking about anymore, the book doesn't have relevancy anymore.
So I do think you kind of have to balance that a little bit. But I mean, again, I think that most books have some sort of underlying theme that they're discussing. The characters are going, I mean, even thrillers, right? Like, I mean, you're talking about the imbalance between predators and power and helplessness and, you know, trauma. Like, there's a lot of things that go into it without necessarily stating the thing.
I mean, if I've got a character that's overweight, usually that's like the least of their problems in one of my book, with everything else going on around them. So it doesn't come up.
Fair enough. All right, awesome.
Oh, hey, can I mention my favorite quote from this interview? I
Yes,
found a
please
favorite
do.
quote. It was right at the end when she said, "You're given this chance to create your own worlds, and you can't delegate that." I love that as a quote.
Yeah, that was a good one.
That was good. That actually reminded me of something that I heard, like I think it was like 2, 3 days ago. But somebody was just talking about ChatGPT being used, for writing books, and it was an attorney, and he said that at some point ChatGPT is going to be able to sue somebody else for plagiarism,
For
which
sure.
is, that may be a thing.
Something to think about for sure. Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. With that, JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Peter Brown coming on. Peter is a New York Times bestselling author of the Wild Robot Children series, the first of which spawned a fantastic movie. His latest book is called The Wild Robot on the Island and releases June 24th. He's one of the most successful children's authors working today. I'm excited to hear how he got there. And selfishly, I booked this one because my daughter absolutely loves the book series and the movie. So, Peter Brown.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.